Welcome to the Diplomats podcast on Asian geopolitics. I'm your host, based in New York City, Ankit Panda. And I'm very pleased to announce that this evening joining me is Jim Creighton. Thank you so much for joining me, Jim.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
After a 30-year career in the U.S. Army, Jim is currently Chief Operations Officer at the East-West Institute based here in New York City, and he's very much an insider into the international effort in Afghanistan. He commanded Combined Team Orozgan in Tarinkot, Afghanistan, and he was additionally the Chief of Plans for ISAF Joint Command in Kabul. Jim additionally drafted the campaign plan for ISAF operations, so he's definitely a very qualified voice on the current events in Afghanistan. Once again, Jim, thanks a lot. Just for listeners, the way we're going to do this podcast is we're going to divide it into two parts. Some of our more dedicated listeners might know that we have had Jim on in the past to discuss the state of Afghan politics. On this podcast, however, we're going to specifically devote half the time to talking about Jim's recent article for The Diplomat. The article is titled Shades of Gray in Afghanistan, and if you're listening to this podcast from our website, you'll find a link to that article in the description. But in this article, Jim reflects on his experiences working with Matiullah Khan, an Afghan warlord who was recently killed in a suicide bombing. Matiullah was a significant political figure and a security provider in Tarinkot, Afghanistan. I'll let Jim describe that in more detail once we get into it. Anyways, Jim, why don't you start us off with just telling us a bit about Orozgan province? It's not an area of Afghanistan that we read about every day in the news, and especially Tarinkot, which is a tiny town, which is where you're based. So what was it like? You know, what was Orozgan like?
Yeah, Orozgan was about 160 miles north of Kandahar. It's where President Karzai came from, and as he grew his base in 2001. Ironically, it's also the place where the mosque of Mullah Omar is, and so it's got a contrasting history to it. It also is very tribally divided between Barakzai and Popalzai, and it's got a strong Pashtun influence in the north, and then a more Barakzai influence in the south. So you have a lot of different tribal cross currents going around, which is one of the things that as you come into an area in this remote part of Afghanistan, you've got to work with. The capital of the province of Orozgan is Tarinkot. It's a town of about 10,000, although you know the last census in Afghanistan was conducted in around 1974. And so as you go in 2005, 2006, there was a lot of conflict. The Taliban was deeply seated in there. The Dutch did a great job of securing the area along with the Australians and providing a more secure environment and allowing some of the development activities to begin to work. And so they did a good job of stabilizing the area. And then when I came in 2010, we were able to adopt a more aggressive approach to both security and development and really move things forward.
Mm-hmm. Now, so as the commander of the combined team, what was your reaction on July 31st, 2010, when you heard the accusation that coalition forces had stabbed a Quran? What was your immediate instinct?
Yeah, my immediate instinct was, okay, this is probably a trumped-up charge, especially coming from the Mirabad Valley, where there were very few coalition there at all. We didn't have, at that time, prominent presence there. In fact, my first visit out to that valley on our way of flying home, we flew over some contact that occurred in the middle of the valley between Australian patrol and some insurgent forces. And so it was not a secure area. There was not a permanent coalition presence in the area, and so my initial reaction was that this is probably not a accurate report.
Mm-hmm. And now you paint a very vivid picture in your piece for The Diplomat about how you eventually went about enlisting Matilda's help in resolving the situation. Could you just very briefly just go into detail about this meeting you had with the Afghan leaders in Orozgan and what that was like for you and what ultimately Matilda did to resolve the situation?
Yeah, absolutely. And it really started about 3 days before that when there was a dispute between the district chief of Chora, one of the districts in Orozgan, and Matilda was able to, through his tribal connections, help mediate that. That meeting took place in the Australian Special Forces compound, where we were able to spend 3 or 4 hours with Matilda and the tribal leaders trying to help resolve some of the conflicts. And that's where I first met him. The Dutch commander was following his instructions and did not have any contact with him. So when the Koran was stabbed, I had already met Matilda and been involved with him for at least one time prior to that. So when he came to the Dutch basically said, "We're not going to work with you." And so he came to me, and I coordinated with the Dutch, and they knew exactly what I was doing and agreed that maybe a different approach would help. So Matilda informed us that he was conducting what is called a Shura, which is a meeting of leaders to resolve problems. And it was going to be at his compound, which is located about a half a mile off of Camp Holland, which is where our headquarters was. So I went out there with 5 of my compatriots, including a fantastic Australian analyst who was a female. And the 5 of us walked into this compound, and we were met by Matilda. We were met by Jim McGool, the chief of police, and General Hamid, the chief of the army, and General Zakaria, who's the chief of the National Defense Security Forces. And they said, "Well, the meeting's already started, and so let's go in and we have a place for you in the front of the room." I looked in, and I'd been in Afghanistan for 14 months, so I'd been in meetings with Afghans. But this was the first Shura that I had been to at the local level. And I walked in, and the room was about the size of 2 bowling alley lanes put together. And there were, I would estimate, well over 100 Afghan leaders, many black turbans, all bearded, the elders of the Mirabad Valley and some other elders within the local Terangkot area. When we got there, all eyes were on us. We walked through the gauntlet, is what the only way I would describe it, to an area right in front of the lectern that was in the front of the room. At the lectern was a mullah, who gray beard, fiery red eyes. He looked like a Baptist preacher in the South, as he was lecturing and preaching to the masses about how the coalition were heathens, that they were blasphemous, that there should be no interaction with the coalition, and that coalition should be targeted. And so the 5 of us were sitting in the front of this room, listening to this for about 45 minutes. A little bit uncomfortable.
I can imagine.
We looked around the room, and they were with rapt attention. So what happened next was that General Hamid, the brigade commander, as soon as the mullah was done, stood up, and he and Matilda escorted us out. He asked politely, he said, "I think we should leave." And I said, "Yes, General Hamid, I think that's a good idea." And so we did. We left the room and we went, and they asked us to wait for them to work with their local leaders. And so we waited in Matula's office for about 4 hours. And at the end, Matula came back in and he said, it's time for you to go back in and meet with the elders. And so we were on our way in, and General Gould, the chief of police, came in and said, no, we've resolved this, and there's no need to meet with the leaders. And so what had happened was that Matula had gathered the local official government leaders together with the tribal elders, many of whom at the time were sympathetic to the Taliban, as evidenced by future fights that we had to secure the Mirabad Valley, which we eventually did, but only because these elders in this meeting had been convinced that the Quran had not been stabbed. And it was just an interesting Afghan justice where, without coalition involvement, the leaders got up and they looked all of these elders in the eye and said, hey, did you see the Quran being stabbed? And of the 100-plus folks in the room, no one had seen the Quran being stabbed. So the question was asked then, okay, so if none of you saw it happen, then it didn't happen. And no one could argue with that. Excuse me. And so they accepted that justice. And they said, well, it must be a false report, and they left. And so that began a very productive arrangement and relationship between myself and Matula, and actually the other leaders within the Erzgan area.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a bit about the critical assessment that the Dutch had? So, you know, in your piece, The Shade of Grey is Matula himself, just for listeners that haven't read it yet. So, you know, you describe Matula as neither an entirely altruistic and good person, but neither, you know, the sort of monster the Dutch kind of make him out to be, as someone that is intentionally planting roadside bombs to then use that to provide security for coalition forces. So what really, you know, outside of this episode, or, you know, maybe through this episode as well, what really drove you to see Matula as someone that you needed to work with as a foreign commander in Afghanistan?
Well, yeah, it actually, in June of that year, the Dutch had invited me to The Hague as the commander coming in, and the Dutch being very proud, and rightfully so, of what they had done. That's where I got my first inclination of their attitude toward corruption. And when I got to Afghanistan, that was one of the major questions that the Australian leadership had asked me of what my plan of action was with regard to that. And so we did some serious analysis on some of the accusations. And he was accused of brutally killing people. He was accused of overcharging for protection along Route Bear, which was the primary supply route down to Kandahar. He was accused of inciting violence along Route Bear when we did not hire him to do the security. And my assessment was that although there was truth in these allegations, the Afghan government had promoted him to the rank of colonel in the Afghan National Police, had given him command of Afghan national security forces, that from a tribal relationship, and I had seen it firsthand, he had the ability to bridge the gap between the tribes, and that he was fiercely opposed to the Taliban and had proven that, and that through U.S. and Australian special forces, he had provided critical security that has enabled those special forces to be much more effective in their clearing operations out in the areas outside of Terrencott. And so I looked at it and I said, well, you know, has this person done bad things in Afghanistan? Probably. Does he provide a stabilizing force within the province? Absolutely. Does he provide financial assistance and support to schools, women, children, businesses throughout the province. Absolutely. And so when I looked at it, I said, there's really no one in Afghanistan that's all good or all bad, including myself. And so the question is he so bad that you won't deal with him? For example, his uncle, John Muhammad Khan, was that person. I mean, he was just a bad, bad guy. And so when he was removed out as the governor of Uruzgan and moved to Kabul, we basically were not very welcoming when he came back into the province. And when he was assassinated in 2011, there weren't a whole lot of tears shed. And so Matula, on the other hand, I thought had, my assessment was, had more good than bad. So he is more white than black. And I would accept the white aspects of him. I would be guarded against the black aspects of him and make sure that to the best extent possible, we steered him away from the black side and took advantage of the white side.
Absolutely. You know, just thinking about Afghanistan in general, you know, warlords like Matula exist across the country from Badakhshan to Kandahar to Herat. And it seems like, you know, any effort to stabilize Afghanistan, either by the Afghan government or by foreign aid agencies, will have to acknowledge the roles of actors like Matula. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. And I think that the more that you leave it in Afghan hands, in terms of helping to make the assessment, helping to make the judgments, the better off you'll be. Mm-hmm. You know, as a coalition commander, I accepted the fact that I had been to Uruzgan exactly one time before I took command. And so my expertise in Uruzgan was minimal compared to Juma Gul, the chief of police, who grew up there, or Cody Rahim, who grew up there, or Matula, right, who his ancestors were there. So you have to listen, first of all, and then make an assessment based on your own viewpoints, your own moral values, and then your assessment of what's being said to you.
Absolutely. Jim, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom on this issue for our listeners today. Now, with the remaining time on this podcast, I actually want to shift gears a bit and talk more about the geopolitics of this region, specifically the relationship between Afghanistan and Pakistan. This is something we touched on during the last podcast when we had you on, but I'd like to get into this in more detail. Now, you told me last time that your perception of Afghan foreign policy towards Pakistan and Pakistan's approach towards Afghanistan ever since Ashraf Ghani came into office has been positive. Now, this is, you know, really intrigues me because historically one of Afghanistan's big problem has been that Pakistan's military intelligence complex has basically been out to destabilize Afghanistan, prevent it from either turning into an Indian partner state or from turning into anything but a buffer state to keep it away from – to keep Pakistan safe from foreign powers. So what are you seeing in the Afghanistan-Pakistan bilateral that is convincing you that things are improving?
It's a great question, and I my assessment was confirmed 2 weeks ago when I visited and met with most of the senior leadership in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. And the bottom line is that from my perspective, after talking to these leaders and then confirmatory meetings with leaders in Kabul, is that when Ashraf Ghani visited Islamabad in November, that started off a rapprochement with Pakistan that continues to this day. And it's not easy because there's, you know, a lot of history and a lot of mistrust, but the president going to Islamabad, meeting with the leaders, and now on several occasions since then, they have begun to develop a series of trust-building measures, including cross-border military cooperation, including easement of taxation and visa requirements on the border, including positive steps toward the implementation of agreements such as the power agreement, CASA 1000 for electrical power, or the TAPI pipeline that is focused on gas works, or the Afghanistan-Pakistan trade and transport agreement, all three of which are agreed to programs that advance commerce, trade, energy trade between Afghanistan and Pakistan, but have been stalled in bureaucratic mistrust. And what you see now is across the board positive inclinations that those obstacles are being removed.
Mm-hmm. One of the episodes that also comes to my mind in terms of relations improving between these two countries is after December's tragic attack against the school in Peshawar, Pakistan. The Pakistani Taliban assailants were apprehended on the Afghan side of the border, I believe, at least some of them, and they were repatriated to Pakistan. So there was some counterterrorism cooperation going on between the Afghan and Pakistani authorities, which is very reassuring to see from my view.
Now, a couple of points on that. First of all, my sensing is that is not an isolated incident, that is occurring more often now, first of all. The second thing is that I believe that there is a realization within Pakistan that the Pakistan Taliban are a much more existential threat to Pakistan than any outside force. And so they recognize that they have internal problems that they have to deal with. And cooperating with Afghanistan helps them with that internal problem.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, the one concern that I'd raise is that when we're discussing these issues, there's always this one actor or this one set of interest that's always very opaque, which is specifically I'm referring to Pakistan's inner services intelligence, the very top military leadership. Historically, they've been cited by several Pakistan experts as a constant thorn in Afghanistan's side. Now, what's your read here? I know that you've been talking about your interactions with Pakistan's leadership, and I'm just wondering if you're including the military leadership in this as well.
So first of all, opaque is a good word to use. My sensing is, and I've not talked directly to the Pakistan leadership, but I've reports indirectly, is that they are in line with the movement of Ashraf Ghani and the political leadership to help stabilize the region. And you know, as you know, the Pakistanis have lost 5,000 plus soldiers in the war on terror. And so they, you know, it's not as though, you know, they have not, you know, definitely got blood in the game in terms of fighting this. The question is how effective are they and who do they let go? And I think that you're seeing signs that that the ISI as well as the military is much more focused on relieving the internal threat. So I think opaque is the right term. You never know really what's going on. But if you look at signs on the ground, it looks like there is movement in a positive direction.
Absolutely. Well, I hope that your assessment is correct, because if relations between Afghanistan and Pakistan do improve in the long term, I think that would be a huge boon for both countries and for stability in the overall region. Anyways, Jim, thank you so much for joining me on this episode of the podcast, and we hope to have you back on again soon to discuss these issues.
No, I look forward to it, and thank you very much for having me on. And I hope and pray that things improve.
Absolutely, as do I. Thank you very much, and we'll be back next week with more.